Hey guys, it's the last day of the COP27 and we're standing outside of the plenary area. Lots of protesters here, climate justice activists, and we're with Asad Rehman. He's with War on Want. He's helping to coordinate the climate justice groups. Asad, thank you very much for being with us. Give us your thoughts on what's happening here, this COP27. What were you guys hoping to accomplish and did it get accomplished?
Well, we came into this COP obviously with Pakistan, my country of origin, underwater, a third of the country flooded, 33 million people displaced, millions of people affected in Nigeria, 55 million people facing issues of hunger across the Horn of Africa because of climate-induced famine. So the scale and the urgency of the climate crisis was ringing. And of course, we saw a number of UN reports that sent the alarm signals again, code red for humanity. We're nowhere near taking enough action to limit temperatures below 1.5. The scale of the climate catastrophes are outstripping the ability of countries to be able to deal with them. And of course, this is not just one crisis. Many countries facing crisis of global cost of living, crisis of inequality, growing issues around hunger. So this is a really important moment for us to get back on track, for the world to commit to limiting those temperatures below 1.5, and of course, provide support to those countries being most impacted. Unfortunately, what we've seen here is, you know, we started the 2 weeks with lots of very strong speeches from world leaders talking about that they recognized that this was a crisis, that we needed to act, but then somehow felt that they weren't the ones that needed to act. Many of the rich countries came here, you know, having expanded fossil fuels back home, the United States, UK.
I guess China is building coal-fired power plants faster than we can count them, huh?
Well, you know, there's still an issue in terms of the biggest polluters, or the ones who are most responsible, are still the big, rich, developed countries. So absolutely, China needs to get off coal, it needs to transition, but so does the United States. And, you know, we've now seen, of course, that under this administration, which says we're climate champions, more permits being permitted for the fossil fuel industry than even under Donald Trump, who was characterized as a climate denialist. So there wasn't a match between action and words.
Interesting. You know, right now the politics in America is very interesting. You've got the Republicans just took back the House of Representatives. You've got Trump just announced that he's running again. He's called climate change a hoax invented by the Chinese. You've got a member of Congress just today posted on Twitter that the idea that CO2 is some sort of pollution is pseudoscience. What do we do with all these climate deniers in America who just refuse to go along with this? And now the Republicans have control of the purse strings. They're not going to pay for any loss and damage. How should the world deal with that?
So I think the way that obviously it's a huge problem within the United States, and we expect the movements in the United States, they've got to win this battle. They've got to draw the links. Who do these people represent? Whose interests are they representing? And increasingly, of course, the reality in the United States itself of forest fires, wildfires, hurricanes, of extreme weather impacts, whether it's Hurricane Katrina or the hurricanes that hit in New York. I think ordinary people are waking up. Ordinary people are joining the dots. This is happening, and it's happening faster, and it's extreme, and it's affecting people's lives and livelihoods. But what the United States could do here is recognize, yes, they might have limitations back home, but it shouldn't prevent other countries from acting. It shouldn't act as a blocker. We've seen in these negotiations, for example, even the question of loss and damage. So if we frame the climate crisis in three simple ways, we know we have to stop doing harm. So that means no more fossil fuels, no more expanding fossil fuels. We've got enough to burn the planet five times over. Why are rich countries expanding more? Why are they going for more oil and gas? The United States here announced a massive new gas infrastructure project in Louisiana. That sends the wrong signal to absolutely every country in the world. The second thing we've got to do is recognize that those countries who caused the harm have to repair the harm. Right, they have to help countries adapt to this, to the realities of this climate crisis. And we know there's been a promise about a global goal on adaptation that was not met here. There's been just reiteration of the words that were agreed in Glasgow, which was we will double adaptation finance. Now, the problem is if you're not giving anything to adaptation, doubling it still means you're not giving anything to adaptation. And the big question here that is the main fissure through is, of course, is also about climate finance. Now, I was in Copenhagen when the when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced the $100 billion goal and said, yes, rich countries, it's a legal obligation, it's a moral obligation, it's a political obligation to provide you support so you can cut your emissions and be able to grow cleanly. And that's written into the Climate Convention. It's accepted into the Paris Agreement as well. That hasn't been met. 13 years later, it's still not been met. In fact, most of the money that has been provided is in debt-creating loans or in private finance. And we're unable to even agree the new...
Do the taxpayers in the United States should pay instead of the others?
Well, no, I tell you who should be paying. The 1% of the world.
George Soros, Bill Gates.
The billionaire class, whose footprint is double the amount of the bottom 50% of the population. The
Bloomberg, people who should be, Rockefeller, George Soros, some names?
Well, I'll tell you, the Jeff Bezos should be paying. Bill Gates should be paying. Absolutely. The billionaires. Look, we've just had a COVID pandemic where the wealth of working people around the world has decreased. But the billionaire class saw their wealth increase between £5 and £10 trillion. I'd tax the wealthy. I'd tax the corporations like the fossil fuel.
They're hiding all their money in tax-exempt foundations, though. How do we get it?
Well, I think there's a different question in terms of the US about philanthropy. We know that billions are being poured by climate denying philanthropy to shift politics within the United States, to tell people lies that climate is not a real issue, to actually reinforce the interests of fossil fuel industries.
So that's a great question. How do you convince it? Because I come from America. There's massive amounts of climate denial. It's politically totally acceptable. Whole states are run by climate denialists. How do you convince an average American that their SUV, their steak, their super cold air conditioner is causing a flood in Pakistan? Because, I mean, there's always been floods in Pakistan. How do you explain to them that that's because of what they're doing and they need to stop?
Well, let's remember first, the majority of people, whether in the global north or in the global south, ordinary people, they're not the ones responsible, right? Their everyday actions are not responsible. What we should be doing is going after the people who are flying private jets.
Like John Kerry.
Like all of them, the number of private jets that flew in here.
Hundreds,
right? The people who are, absolutely. Look, we have to talk to ordinary people and people have to see that what we're promising people is a better life, not less, so that they can lead healthier, cleaner lives. Look, ordinary people, working class people, working people all around the world, they're losing their lives from air pollution. We can promise people a cleaner environment. People don't want to be sitting in cars, spending hours and hours driving in gridlock. What we should be doing is redesigning our cities so people can work, can connect with their communities, be with their families, work better. We should have better public transport, cleaner, free, electrified. We should be talking about healthier food. The fact that we've got 2 billion people around the world going hungry, but 1 billion people facing health issues because of obesity. Let's fix our food system. Let's make sure that people aren't priced out of eating good food. We can do all of these things. It's not impossible. And that will do it. Cut carbon. It will help be healthier lives. It'll save people money in their pockets. And of course, it'll make sure that we leave a planet where humanity can actually survive and thrive on.
Very good. And so they haven't quite come to an agreement yet, as I understand. Do you expect anything significant to come out of this? What do you think are the highlights of what's the final stretch of the negotiations?
Well, the big elephant in the room is what do we do about loss and damage? You know, which is if you cause the problem and you can't repair it, do you pay compensation? And I put it very, very simply. If I burn down your house, should you come and expect me to pay for it? Of course you would. You'd expect me to compensate you. And so what we're seeing around the world is developing countries, poorer communities saying, we didn't cause this crisis. You rich countries did. And so you have to help us. And the United States said, we don't want to even talk about a process of fund, not even putting any money in, just the idea of a process of a fund. We've seen the European Union saying, oh, well, let's talk about vulnerability. Look, your vulnerability of narrowing it down to a handful of countries. On their criteria, a country like Pakistan, where 70% of the people live in poverty, where people basically survive day to day, is being told you are not vulnerable. That's one of the most vulnerable countries in the world because climate is impacting with poverty and inequality. So that is going, unless we deal with that, I think this climate negotiations will what should have brought hope to millions, which should have been a step forward in terms of tackling the climate crisis, will stumble backwards.
So no progress at all, nothing for climate justice activists to celebrate after this 2-week-long meeting, nothing?
Well, I think there's a lot to celebrate. I think what there is to celebrate is the fact that civil society here in their thousands from all corners of the world are connecting better, uniting, are talking about the importance of solidarity. In the side events, we're putting forward proposals about how do we fix our food systems, our transport systems, our cities, talking about that where you need to guarantee people the ability to be able to live with dignity. We have the solutions. We can see what needs to be done. What is lacking is the political will, because there are leaders in there who are answerable more to the fossil fuel lobbyists than they are to the citizens. If those fossil fuel lobbyists wouldn't be in here, I think we'd see a very, very different outcome. You'd not ask the tobacco industry to determine public policy and health policy on cigarettes. That's exactly what's being expected here.
But how do you get the political will? Like, you live in the UK, you said. Right now, there's talk that there's going to be blackouts this winter in the UK. It gets cold there. Same thing in the United States. Same thing in Germany, France, Switzerland, Japan. They're all talking about blackouts. How do you get political will when people are struggling to keep the lights on to go further on this?
So, absolutely. So, we know we need to cut the amount of energy we use. Well, so let's be more efficient about it. Let's make people's homes, retrofit them so that they're warmer, so they're not spending so much on energy bills. So we're reducing the amount of energy that we need. Let's change the amount of energy that we use from fossil fuels to renewable energy. We've got the technology. We've got the capacity. We can create thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of new jobs for people, good jobs, clean jobs that pay decent wages by retrofitting our homes, by putting solar panels on our schools, on our public buildings, and making energy something that ordinary people can be able to afford. Nobody, whether in the United States or the UK or in the global south, should be asking themselves the question, can I afford to eat or heat? And that's what this current system has left them. So this current system is not working to people. Let's fix it and let's put in a system that actually does cut emissions, does ensure that people can live with dignity, and of course, make sure that we're not sacrificing people from the rest of the world to ensure that we can live this kind of lifestyles that we have, which largely have been unhealthy, unhappy, and actually, and ultimately are devastating for the planet.
Asad Rehman, thank you very much. Any final words of wisdom? Where can people learn more about War on One?
So, we work with partners of frontline movements from all around the world. Look us up on the website, www.waronone.org. Of course, and wherever you are, be part of the movement. The history of humanity has shown that it's when ordinary people organize, come together, that we transform things. We ended slavery and colonialism, gave women the right to vote, we gave people the right to join trade unions. It's been the power of ordinary people that shifts politics. So we have to say that those political leaders are only going to be shifted when we make that change.
Very good. Thank you so much.
No problem.